First, I'm Joe. I'm an alcoholic. I always forget that. Isn't that amazing? I couldn't forget it today. I was coming through the hotel earlier tonight, and I passed the bar, and I said, God, there's nobody in the bar. I wonder where everybody is. Tonight, I feel like we're real privileged to have our speaker here tonight. He's actually here speaking a day early for us, and I think it's just always amazing to me how God works in our lives. Carol and I had the good fortune of meeting our speaker, Lou, and his wife, Linda, earlier today, and what a beautiful couple, and we're glad to have you here. Please join me and welcome our speaker, Lou Finnamore, all the way from British Columbia.
Thank you, Joe. I hope somebody in the committee can tell me what this green stool's for. When I went to school, they had one of them in every classroom, and you know what in hell they were for. My name is Lou Finnamore, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. Two things about that are vital to me. One is my last name. And second, it says in here, this is how 100 alcoholics have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. It says, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. Further on, it says, why shouldn't we be happy? We have recovered. Chapter 5 says, those who do not recover. And if you want to know a little something about anonymity, read the second to the last page in the pamphlet, Understanding Anonymity, and read page 264 and 265 in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, and it'll cover it in great depth. I will never give your name or address out, but I want to tell you, if you think the world isn't confused, we turn 2 million people loose on them with no last names. My name is Bob S., and I'm an alcoholic. I'm sorry for the Al-Anon gals that Smitty wasn't here. Him and I spoke together last weekend. Great guy. Getting married in August, 85 years old. Got a lovely little lady. Him and I were talking last weekend. He's a lot like me. His mind makes contracts his body can't keep. Anyway, I'm going to be referring to this big book periodically. It's going to catch on one day, our fellowship. It's cheap, and it contains a lot of vital information, which is totally foreign to us, which is called reality. But isn't it amazing in here? It says, if you want what we got, and how often do we ever qualify people for that? How often do we ever qualify them? If you want what we got. I always think of the story, I tell it quite often, the teenage son of a minister. And he went to his dad one day and he said, Dad, when can we talk about me driving the car? And he said, well, I'll tell you. He said, when you bring your grades up and I see you reading the Bible on a regular basis and you get that long haircut, we'll talk. So about 4 months later, he came to his dad and he said, can we talk about me driving the car? His dad said, well, there's no doubt. He said, I've seen your grades come up a bit and you have been reading the Bible pretty regular, but you still got that long hair. Said to his dad, he said, you know, Jacob had long hair, and Moses had long hair, and Jesus had long hair. And his dad said, you notice they walked everywhere they went. So I hate to tell you, if you want what we got, you might have to get a haircut. Along with a whole lot of other things. I'm going to be talking a little bit about the steps tonight. In fact, a whole lot about them. And these steps are very simple. They're not a complicated thing. They're not designed to bring any harm to you or to your family or to the community you live in. They're very simple. Steps 1 and 2, you fess up. 3, you look up. 4, 5, 6, and 7, you clean up. 8 and 9, you pay up. And 10, 11, and 12, keep it up. Just that simple. And I'd like to tell you right now, There's only one way that I could get from a Salvation Army mission on the Skid Row to Vancouver to Marietta, Georgia, and that's through the grace of God and people like you. How many people are attending their very first AA roundup? Look at that. God bless you. Kick your shoes off and enjoy it. We're throwing this party just for you. You know, I look back and think of the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's covered in this book in the earlier stages, in the beginning of it, where it says, I must be hard on myself but considerate of others. I is the smallest word in the English language and carries the least amount of importance. And we start everything off with I. What'd you do on the weekend, Lou? I went to the movies. Not Linda and I. You'd think I'd traveled alone my whole life. It's amazing. This thing is about, you know, God's will for me is to be happy, joyous, and free. And that has absolutely nothing to do with what I do for me. It has all to do with how I treat you. And we just don't think about that. We wake up with the gimmies and go to bed with the wants. And that's the way we've lived our whole life. That's the way we've lived our whole life. And it's like the young fellow was sitting on a bus one day and he had a little card in his lap. And this old bird about my age got on and sat down beside him and had this beautiful arrangement of flowers just before Valentine's Day. He looked at the old guy and he said, boy, somebody's going to get a nice gift this Valentine's Day. And the old fellow said, yep. He said, the young fellow, he said, do you have a girlfriend? He said, yes, I do. He said, I'm giving her a card this year. That's all I can afford. The old fellow said, that's good. A little ways further on, the old fellow reached up and pulled the cord to get off of the bus. And as the bus was pulling in to the curb, he laid the arrangement of flowers in the young fellow's lap. And he said, give these to your girlfriend. He said, my wife would like that. And the young fellow watched as he got off the bus and walked through the gates into a cemetery. So this whole thing is about change. There's nothing to these 10, 12 steps. You just change your whole life. And I don't care how long you've been sober. I don't care how much money you've got. I don't care where you live or anything else. This whole thing is about, am I willing to change? I change every day something. When I meet a new person, I have to change. They don't have to change. Of all of the men that I sponsor, I have never referred to one as a dummy, a jerk, a pigeon, or anything else. They are human beings. They walk, talk, and shake hands. And I pray to God I never get to the stage where I feel superior to them. I know in the book it says it's not uncommon for us to want to feel superior to our fellow man and float above them on brain power alone. But I want to tell you, you listen to most drunks, and their brains would make elastic, they wouldn't have enough to make a jockstrap for a mosquito. I'll tell you. You know, you got all kinds of these cliches from the podium. You know, don't let little things bother you. Try sleeping with a mosquito. When I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, they said no relationships for the first year. Every one of them that told me that was married. Then the next guy said to me, don't make any major decisions for the first year. But admit you're an alcoholic, that you're crazy. Turn your life over to somebody you can't see and won't talk to. Make a list of what a no-good SOB you are and tell it to a complete stranger. Make a list of all the people you've harmed and become willing to meet them face to face, but don't make any major decisions for the first year. There, now we got the spiritual part over with. I was born, I know some of you won't believe that, but in a little town right on the border of the state of Maine in eastern Canada, right by where the big air base was in Limestone, Maine. My real mom, I was taken away from her when she owned a hotel or run a hotel in a railroad divisional town. My daddy worked for the railroad. And she was an absolutely stunning woman in her younger years. She looked just like Olivia de Havilland. She wore the floppy hat. She was just stunning. And she supplied the men with everything, food, loving, and lodging, from what I can hear. And one time in December, which is very cold in the Maritime Provinces, Eastern Canada, she went out on one of her evenings or weeks or 2 weeks, or God knows how long it was, with a fella. And a lady who was the sister of the person who became my mom found me in this old house. And my mom was telling Linda that I'd been left there so long and had laid in this crib and had wet where I'd wet myself, and that there was no hair left on me at all. It had just been rubbed right off. And she found me, and in them days there was not all these adoption agencies and counseling services. There was none of it. They just took and gave you to a family who would raise you, and that's what they did. They gave me to the two people who became my mom and dad. And they gave me back to my mom apparently 3 or 4 months later, and it only lasted a month or so when I was taken away and given back to the two people who raised me. Now, I'm going to make this fairly quick in some areas. Daddy couldn't read or write a word. We found out when we went back and got Mom and brought her out in 1991 that she had grade 5 education. She was a mom. She stayed at home and she worked. And she cooked good food, seeing that I had good clothes, an opportunity for an education. And Dad worked his butt off for nothing as a laborer on the railroad. And I'm going to tell you, when I was 11 years old, I met my real mom. I got to see her. And it's funny that when she died many years later in a hospital, the dad that I was turned over to was in the next room, and their heads were just like that and just a wall, and nobody knew that. But what is interesting, when I was 16 years of age, I went on a party on a Friday night with a couple of three of my buddies, and I had been in a lot of trouble by then, a lot of trouble. I come back on Wednesday the following week with these, and they drop me off at the house. And the only way I could have been any drunker is to be bigger. I was just paralyzed. And I walked into the house. My mom was a little short lady, about 5 foot tall. And these are the things that I just hope I don't ever forget. You see, we talk about making amends. You can say you're sorry. You can live a different life. But there's some things you will always remember. And she started giving me a lecture, as I suppose any mother would. And why, I don't know. I have no idea. But I hauled off and smashed her right in the face, and she went down in front of our kitchen sink. And I grabbed some clothes and took off, and I went to Halifax, Nova Scotia. And I started driving truck for Allied Van Lines. In 1985, Mom asked me if I'd come back home and see her. She was 72 years old the next time I seen her. And I'm a tough guy, too. I've been in just about every jail from Rockhead and Halifax to Vancouver. And I see all kinds of guys that come to my office. I just retired as a therapist. And I've seen all kinds of guys come into my office and say, "I was a good fighter, too, Lou." And they had scars going 17 directions. And I'd hate to tell them, good fighters got no marks. You know, it took a good man to beat me. It didn't take him long, but it took a good one. And isn't it amazing? We come in here defeated in every single area of our life and still trying to tell us we were good at something. I come in here because I was bad at everything. Bad at everything. But in 1985, she phoned and asked me to come back home. 72 years old. I missed all those years. I missed all those years. And the life I lived is indescribable. And I started driving for Allied Van Lines, and the Bible in Harvest Greeley's Premonition has said, "Go west, young man, go west." So I did. I went to the west coast. And the Bible says the wise men come from the east, and I've been wise enough to stay the hell out west. That's about the extent of my wisdom. I never come in here with a ton of wisdom. But when I look at my life today, and feel, if you only knew how I feel standing here today from where I came from, don't ever give me that line, you don't know what it's like. I said, really, get a cup of coffee and sit down for an hour. This thing walks, talks, and shakes hands. It's not just for the rich or just for the poor or just for the black or just for the white. It's a fellowship of men and women who share their experiences, strength, and hope. And there's a lot of difference between sharing experiences than imposing your opinions. And I think sometimes we get those really confused, because we come into Alcoholics Anonymous and we absolutely refuse to see how we treated society, how we treated our families, how we treated our creditors, how we treated our neighbors, how we treated the people we met on a bus. We refuse to see how we treated them. I hear people say, well, you know, I've done a few bad things, really. Sit down and compare them with someone else. Maybe you never done anything bad. And yet, in your perception, they were bad. How you perceived it. It's like the psychiatrist that was going to this mental hospital to see a bunch of his alky patients. About 10 o'clock in the morning, he walked out. Have a coffee break. Here was this guy out there with a pile of bricks and a wheelbarrow full of cement building a wall. One of the patients. And he said to this guy, pray tell me why you're in here. He said, my family resented me, so they had me committed. Well, he said, I've never seen bricklaying like that in my life. It's a piece of symmetrical beauty. He said, we could use people with your talents on the outside. He said, I'm on the board of this hospital. And when it meets on Monday, I'm going to stand on your behalf. And he said, I'll have you out of here on Thursday. And he turned to walk away, and this idiot threw a brick and hit him right in the back of the head, and down he went. And when he finally come to, he stood up and turned and looked at this guy, and he said, now, why did you do that? He said, I just didn't want you to forget Monday. And I mean, this is the way we've gone through life. Wonder why people reacted the way they did. And that was the story of my whole life. Like, I will get into a bit of it, and like it's so bizarre, I find today as I tell it, and as I lived it, and as I know it, I still find some of it hard to believe. I did things that were unbelievable and had no reason to do it. None. It was just what I did. If anyone would say, why did you do that? I wouldn't have had an answer. And that's bad for a drunk to be stuck for an answer. Don't ever get in that spot, whatever in hell you do, please. And I started driving. When I got to Vancouver, the place that I went for my first night in Vancouver was the Arco Rooms, which is right above where our old detox was in the Skid Row to Vancouver. And I had a room overlooking. I don't know what. It didn't have a window. But and I found the Skid Row area, I still today speak highly of it. I found it a very comfortable place. Nobody bugs you. Your family don't look for you. Creditors don't look for you. Your kids don't bother you. Nobody knows you. Your own brother wouldn't tell anybody if you're there. I mean, there's a lot of comfort there that people don't even think of. Because, you see, our idea of comfort is to have a lot of things. You see, their idea of comfort is not to be bothered. Now, when you got a whole lot of things, you're going to be bothered periodically. See, they're never bothered. And so, to me, that became a way of life. And I love to sing. I used to like to sing in the clubs and the legions and music. I love it. I just love it. I met a fellow one night in a beer parlor. This was so interesting how this happened. And he said, I'm going up to see this lady. And he said,
I've never seen so many people just stand up and applaud. It was just great. I can't, and it's a marvelous.
I could barely move my legs. So we drove out to this house, and this woman had just been evicted that day with four children from the house she was in, and they carried everything five houses down to this new one they moved into. And about 8:30 or 9, somewhere in that area that night, Chuck and I arrived at this house. And this woman didn't know me, but she knew him. And she took and ordered him out and pushed me down the stairs, locked the door. And we went and slept in this car all night. And the next morning when we woke up, somewhere through a fog, I remembered this house. And I said to Chuck, I said, where were we last night? And he told me. I said, take me back there. Now, on the way back, I got him to stop at a little grocery store, and I got a loaf of bread, a dozen eggs, and a pound of bacon. And we walked into this woman's house, and I walked in as if I owned it. And I put this stuff on the counter, and I said, cook me some breakfast. And she did, and I was there for the next 11 years. I'm just like a dog. You feed me, and I don't leave. Well, this woman thinks she had troubles before. She didn't know what trouble was. And as it turned out, we found out later, her ex-husband, Huey, him and I used to sing together at the Army Navy Club up on Seymour Street. And here I am. I've moved in with his wife. And I looked around. I got a job with Johnson Terminals, a trucking company, the largest trucking company in British Columbia. And I got looking around after a while, and I thought the stuff in this house, which all came from St. Vincent de Paul, is not good for my family. And I got rid of it and started getting new stuff. And this woman had never, ever been introduced to bailiffs in her life. Now, in British Columbia, maybe not down here, but in them days, they could repossess everything in your home except the beds that the children slept on. They couldn't take the beds, but they could come in at any given time if you didn't make a payment and repossess whatever they wanted. Well, I want to tell you, it was just a steady flow of stuff coming and going. Now, my wife is here today, and she's talked to a lot of people. It is incredible. I never had any intentions of paying anybody for anything in my life. Now, this is sad. I had no intention of paying for it. I'd buy a car, and they'd say, what can you afford, Mr. Finner? I said, I don't know. What's it work out at? Well, you know, car salesman. 7 pages of paper later, they said, how's $381 a month? I said, right on. Couldn't be better. You see, we don't like making decisions. Agreeing with them, yes. Not making them. Okay? So what the hell's the difference? What number he come up with? He ain't going to get nothing out of me. And do you know, it's absolutely amazing. Every time that I ever bought anything in credit, the person I was buying it from always come up with the right figure for a payment. Not one of them was too high. Well, this started. Now, I'm going to tell you something about purchasing on credit. It's an interesting thing. When you buy something on credit, they have an agreement, and they give you all the details and the interest charges and when the first payment is to be made and the last payment. They say, would you sign here? And I did. And we never turn it over and read it. I don't anyway. I shouldn't say we. Now, there's something on there that is very annoying to the alcoholic. Sales agreement doesn't bother him at all. But there's a word ahead of that always. Conditional sales agreement. What does our book say? It said we thought conditions drove us to drink. And when we couldn't change the conditions to our entire satisfaction, our drinking went out of control. It said it never occurred to us. We must change ourselves to meet the condition. It says the problem with the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. You can talk about any portion of a man's anatomy. He'll even brag about some, but don't discuss his head. He don't want anyone in there unsolicited telling him he's nuts. So, you see, it's the conditional part of the agreement that really gets to us. And then we say, well, you know, I've had a lot of problems. That has to be included in the conditional part. Problems do come. Many of them of our own making. It says in the book, we were the makers of our own problems, not drinking. I am so sad that alcohol is blamed for so many things it had nothing to do with. So I look back on these things and all of the repossessions that Winnie went through and how many times that we split up. My God Almighty, you would never know. And we had 2 more children. We had 6. And today there's 6 children and 14 grandchildren and 5 great-grandchildren. And I think they're fine. I don't understand a lot of their language today, and I don't have to. That's the one nice thing about grandchildren. They're all cool and awesome and totally radical and far out, and every now and then I say, uh-huh, and that's all I have to say. And they just love me to death. I don't know what's going on. I haven't got a clue. And I don't want to, because we live in 2 different worlds. And so what's important is for me to try to understand, not to understand. God wants me to try to understand. God doesn't want me to try and dictate to anybody, to try and control anybody. I know none of you people ever do that, but I think of the lady walking down the road with street one day with two little boys, one in each hand. She meets a neighbor. And the neighbor said, "Good morning, Mrs. Smith. How old are the boys?" She said, "The doctor's 4 and the lawyer 6. And, and I think in many cases this is the way that we've gone through life. So the last time that Winnie and I split up, and she remarried my best friend, and she is still one of our best friends today. Linda and I talk to her at least once a week. Her husband just died last year. But her and I were split up the last time, and I went back to the famous place that always went was the Skid Road. And on November the 16th of 1963, I had my last drink. That's the day that Dr. Bob died, his date. But I came out of the Skid Road of Vancouver and went back up to this house, and I had a half a bottle of wine with me. And how I got there, I have no idea where she was living. But I rang the doorbell, and she came to the door, and she was always famous for asking stupid questions. She said, "What are you doing here? How the hell would I know? I didn't even know how I got there." And she said, "Well, come on in." So I went in. Now, I want to tell you the situation that we were in, she was in. Every stick of furniture had been repossessed except the beds for the kids. The lights was disconnected. Our phone was shut off. This was 6 weeks before Christmas. She was cooking on a Coleman camp stove to feed the kids whatever she had to feed them. And Einstein returned. The next morning I woke up. I went to take a drink of this wine, and a voice as clear as can be said, "Lou, your drinking days is all over." I don't know where I ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no idea. But I said to Winnie, I said, "What's the number of Alcoholics Anonymous?" She said, "If you want the goddamn number, look it up." I don't like using those words, but that was the exact words she said. And that's the most she'd said to me in months, and I thought, now she's thinking of reconciliation. I went and looked the number up, but I couldn't phone. The phone disconnected. I went next door to a guy who worked for Molson's Breweries, and I phoned Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, he was one of my drinking buddies. He's sitting there listening to this conversation, me phoning Alcoholics Anonymous. And in them days, like in our intergroup office today, when you phone for help, they fill out a piece of paper about that long, more facts about you than enough, and not knowing you're only going to stay here 4 days. They said, "How old are you?" And I said, "I'm 28. Where do you live?" And I told him, and she said, "I'll send two guys up to see you." And so I hung up and come back, and I said to Winnie, "There's two guys coming to see me." And I started getting a whole bunch of stuff ready to ask them, and some of it fairly intellectual. And that's bad for an alky, because an intellectual is a person who's educated beyond their capacity to understand. So these two guys arrived. And they sent two of the dumbest idiots I've ever met, two brothers, and they're back where I'm from on the East Coast. Now, when you got two people come to see you and you all got to sit on the floor, you shouldn't really have a lot to say. But I did. And I started. And I started on my next door neighbor, and this one brother, he said, "Hold it, Luke." He said, "We live and let live." And then I started worrying about Christmas 6 weeks away, and he said, "Nope, we do this one day at a time." And every now and then he'd poke his brother in the ribs and he'd say, "Ain't that right, Don?" He'd say, "Yep." And that's all he said. Every time he'd get a whack in the ribs, he'd say, "Yep." And I thought, right here I know that I'm not that dumb. I'd move over. You only hit me once. So they listened to me till about 5 o'clock. And about 5 o'clock they'd had all they could take, and they got up and they said, "We're going to have dinner, and we'll be back to get you at 8 o'clock for a meeting tonight, my first meeting." And they said, "Now just remember, don't take that first drink, and you'll stay sober." And out they went. And I looked at Winnie and I said, "You know, that guy's got something." About 4 months later, it hit me. How inconsiderate can you be to get two guys to drive 40 miles to tell you if you don't drink, you'll stay sober? I'd never thought of that. I thought, what a hell of an idea they got. Just talk common sense to a drunk and he won't know what's going on. Stay out of this theory stuff. Stay out of that. When they left, I ran across the alley to a guy's house that I was drinking with downtown the next day. And for the next 2 or 3 minutes, I want you to listen. This is what meant more to me than anything that's ever happened. I walked up his back stairs. across his patio and in his kitchen. He's sitting there with a glass of whiskey. He went to take a drink, and I said, put that down, it'll kill you. He looked at me and said, what happened to you? I said, I quit drinking. He said, when? I said, must be 6-8 hours now. Well, he looked out the window to see if the Jehovah's Witness or something had got a hold of me, and he said, would you leave? And I left. And I want to tell you, that'll be 39 years this November the 16th, and he's never spoke a word. He's never spoken a word to me from that day to this. Isn't that sad? What's it say in this book? It says, if we are properly armed with facts about ourselves, we can win the confidence of our fellow alcoholic in a matter of hours. Until this has been done, little or nothing can be accomplished. Facts about herself, not AA. I see people after the first meeting say, boy, I got a sister that could use this and a brother-in-law that should be here, and I'm thinking, I hope they move to hell out of British Columbia or they'll never get any peace. If you want someone to come here, let them come here by your example. Please, carry the message of your recovery. Please. I'd like to tell you about my first meeting. They took me to my first meeting. I'm 6 foot tall, 128 pounds, 4 pounds of that's ears. If anyone's ever drank on the Skid Roads wine, when you're cold and shiver, those little goosebumps, they'll all break out and infect and fester. I had those wine sores all over me and a black shoe and a brown shoe on. And the first guy inside the door, he's dead now, Jerry Eklund, he said, welcome, you're in the right place. And I said, I don't believe it. 28 years old, first time anyone told me I was in the right place. I had a lot of magistrates tell me where I should be. Some even went further than that. I had 41 charges, charged 41 times in 5 years. And I ran around AA saying I was charged 41 times for fighting. And an old-timer said to me, he said, nobody has ever been charged with fighting in the history of British Columbia in a courtroom. He said, you were charged with creating a disturbance in a public place. He said, you couldn't fight good enough to get an assault charge. We like to make it sound like we were tough. I want to tell you, liquor will beat you down to nothing. But they set me right where this gentleman is sitting here in the corner on the front row. And every speaker that night was about my age. They were all collector's items. With them suspenders, you know, they'd lean way back. Hearing aid, false teeth, a cane. Saying, if you want what we got. And I'm thinking, hell, I can't wait to get it. Where do you keep it? And they'd all stand up there, and I swore they'd give each one of them, you know, about $12 worth of change, and they'd rattle out and say, material things don't mean nothing. And I thought, well, if I looked like you, they wouldn't mean a hell of a lot to me neither. And after the meeting, I watched these people leave in Buicks and Cadillacs and Lincolns, and I thought, now I missed something in their damn talk. And it's amazing how this program works, friends. Material things mean nothing to me today, because I got them. I don't know about you people. How many of you people sat with a new guy or a new gal and she's just lost her partner and you're saying, that ain't important, get to a meeting. Really? They've just lost their car. That ain't important. You'll get another car, get to a meeting. I want to tell you, that's an opinion. Everything is important today. Nothing is as important to me today as my God. Second is AA and my wife. I have a little Jack Russell Terrier, Wishbone. That wake up every morning and have that little dog come over and give me a kiss, go to the golf course with me and ride the golf cart as I'm filling the water bottles. I want to tell you, everything is important. To have someone say, I love you. You can't buy that at Macy's. They don't sell it. So don't ever tell anybody that what you got and they don't have isn't important. If it is, if it's not important, why don't you give them what you got that they want? and see if it's important. Everything is important. This program is about important things. God, people, love, unselfish service, giving to others. Do unto others, you should have them do unto you. This thing is all about that. That's what it's all about. And my whole life, from then on, everything I've ever dreamed of has come true. Every place I've ever wanted to go, I've been. And everybody I've ever wanted to meet, I've met. I have had a life that is beyond anyone's wildest dreams. And I'm at I'm just going to tell you a little bit about a couple of things that's happened. 2 weeks after I sobered up, I borrowed $200 and bought an old truck and started a trucking company. I got rid of that, and I got my second truck. And all of a sudden, I realized I was so busy looking for the second truck, they repossessed the first one. And then I thought that every successful businessman should have a Cadillac, so I got a Cadillac. And there's nothing wrong with that. I love them. But they repossessed that. But... And I mean, I was going to 13 meetings a week, and they disconnected my lights, shut the phone off, repossessed a Cadillac, took a truck away, and I'm going like crazy to meetings. If I had to quit work at 4 o'clock, I'd have that big white Cadillac Coupe de Ville right in front of the door. And everybody'd say, boy, Lou must be doing good. Now it appeared that way. Let's go over in the book a little further. Outward appearances is not inward reality at all. We absolutely believe that we must look good at all cost. This book tells me just the opposite. It says what has happened in the spiritual experience in the back of the book. It says what has happened is he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that which he could not have done on his unaided strength alone. An alteration to life. Look up the meaning. When you do an alteration in your house, you tear down, it's all brand new. And I think these are the things that's important, is to look at what is said. And do you know, all of a sudden they seemed fit to give me 3 new trucks on credit. And that was the beginning of my story. But that Christmas came along, and somebody hooked our lights up. And somebody had our phone hooked up. And somebody bought Winnie and I and the kids a turkey dinner and all the trimmings. And somebody seen that the 5 children, there was 5 then, all had a Christmas present. We got 7 Christmas cards that went that year, and my name was not on one of them. It was just to Winnie and the kids. Today, I get 300 to 400, and I know every single person they come from Africa to Vancouver. So God has been so good to me, blessed me with so many things. But I got involved in an in-depth steps study series, which I chaired for 31 years. And everything is on paper. And it's all laid out on paper. And I think it's important that we look at these steps as they're printed, not as we interpret them, because in the dictionary, interpretation says avoidance of truth. There's 5 of these steps that has the word "and" in them. Anytime "and" is used means there's something following. Principles in all our affairs. I hear people say that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives have become unmanageable. There's no "and" there. Don't add one. There's a dash. That mom of mine died 2 years ago, last month. And you see, her headstone would read Yvonne Marie Fenimore, 1913-2000. 1913 and 2000 mean nothing. Those figures mean nothing. What means everything is the dash. What means everything is the dash. What did you do with your life from the day you were born till the day you go? You see, I believe today that God, from the moment I'm born, God's preparing me for death. What's important is what I do in between. And it said we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Isn't that amazing? Why didn't they say we admitted we were alcoholic and that we were powerless? Why wouldn't they put it that way? I've thought that over a lot. See, the longer I BS, the less power I had to quit it. The longer I lied, the less power I had to quit. The longer I was unfaithful to my wife, the less power I had to quit. Alcohol just relieved the discomfort of all those things I couldn't stop doing. And that my life had become unmanageable. Mine was unbelievable. It said we came to believe that a power greater than yourself. I hear people say, I have trouble with this believing in this God. They don't give me that choice. These steps are all in past tense. It says we came to believe that a power greater than herself, not in a power greater than herself, could restore us to sanity. See, for 20 years in AA, I restored vintage cars as a hobby. And I had to look up the meaning of the word restore. And it says to return to original form. I've been returned to what I was as a little boy. I trust, I love, I forgive, I care. I'll forget. I've been returned to what I was as a wee boy. And these steps are so simple that it's ridiculous. And we try to make them sound as though they're just a real complex deal. Only one of the whole 12 that they ask us to make a decision. 25% of these steps involve writing. We don't like that neither. That's the reason we don't like inventories. We either don't have any paper or can't find a pen. It says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives, and it doesn't say we turn it over to God. Doesn't say that at all. It says we turned it over to the care of God. I could say to Dick and Barbara, if I was living here, would you babysit our son tonight while we go to the play? And I've left that boy in their care. When the play's over, I must take him back and nurture him and love him and raise him. See, I hear people say, when God wants me to have a job, I'll have one. I'm saying, who in hell are you praying to? My God, I've been looking for God's employment agency for 70 years. I needed a drink to go apply for a job, and once I got the drink, I was too good for it. I mean, up where I come from, most of the young people today, if the desire to work hits them, they lay down till it leaves. When they say, I turn it over, what's it? I mean, you better get a handle on that. What is it if you turn it over? Everything I turned over to him, he turned them right over to a bailiff, and they repossessed him. He's very unreliable in a hell of a lot of areas. So I think these are the things that I look at and that I do an inventory, a searching and fearless, not a fearful immoral, but a fearless moral. And it says, I admit to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature, singular, no S on that. It's not the natures of my wrongs. I could say I messed around on my wife, which I did. That's the wrong. What they want to know is why. And I thought, ooh, they're really getting personal. These old birds in here, boy, will strip the britches right off you. We're talking about the exact nature of the wrongs. It says we made a list of all persons we had harmed. It doesn't say hurt. And become willing to make amends to them all. I hear people say, well, you know, I apologized to my brother today. That's not an amend. That's an apology. That's an apology. An amend is don't ever say it again. See, when they amend the Criminal Code of Canada in Vancouver, up in Canada, they don't all stand up and apology. They apologize. They probably should. But they change it, and the man is to change. And it says, continue to take personal inventory, and it says, when we were wrong, not if we were wrong, promptly admitted it. It doesn't say explain it. I never admitted anything to my life. I'd say to Joe, you know, I'm sorry for what I said to you last Saturday night. And if he never said nothing back, I said, now I'm going to tell you the reason I said it, and give me 3 minutes, and I'll have him apologize, and he was even at the party. And that's what I want. If it takes me all day, I'll turn this around. And I sold that trucking business and went into custom design jewelry for 3 years, and from there selling Electrolux vacuum cleaners to get some experience in rejection. And they still tell a story about me up in at the Electrolux conventions. I was working out in Deep Cove. I was just 3 or 4 days in the job, and you know they give you them pep talks on Monday morning, them idiots. And I head out with a vacuum cleaner in one hand, a shampoo in the other, and I rang this lady's doorbell. And she opened it, and I gave her my card, and I said, good morning, I'm Mr. Finnemore, I'm your Electrolux representative in this area now. And I never knew a door could be slammed that hard and a house still stay upright. I don't know why I did it. I went around the back of the house and rang her doorbell, and she come there, and I said, God, I hope you're not as unhappy as the lady who was just at the front door. I never sold her a vacuum. I didn't have to. I sold lots of them. But we sat down and talked. And I found out what her problem was. And you know, this is the whole thing, what this thing about is breaking down barriers. We were asked to go to Russia. We never went over and told them they should have us. Just practice these principles in all your affairs instead of being like me in the beginning, practicing affairs with no principles. Just reverse that, and you'll be amazed what you'll be asked to do and what you'll be invited to do. You'll be amazed. And so I think these are the things that I look at today. is what have I got to offer today? I set up the alcohol and drug program 13 years ago for the province of British Columbia in the BC Racing Commission, thoroughbred and standardbred horse racing. In 1993, it was adopted as the role model program for all 57 racetracks in North America. Our conventions used to be in Louisville at Churchill Downs. I've had some great experiences. But my greatest one was in 1990, I was asked to speak as a fill-in speaker at a convention in Cranbrook, BC. And the way I go up there, and as it happened, Linda lived a province away, 700 miles away in Alberta. She was supposed to be at a birthday party, but instead she went out to Cranbrook to take this drunken nephew to this roundup to see if he'd hear anything. And it couldn't have worked out better. He's still drunk and we're married. And she's here with me tonight, and we were talking today. We have never had an argument or disagreement. Never have. And the reason is, there's a lot of reasons. I wouldn't want to change a thing about her. I wouldn't want her to change anything. I wouldn't want her to be any different. And her and I are so different. So different. In every walk of life. And yet we do everything together. We were saying tonight, I was saying, I probably buy 90-95% of everything she wears, her clothes. When I go traveling and speaking, I always buy her an outfit. When I shower in the morning, I wash the walls down, the glass doors are all done, the countertops are done, the taps are all polished. You'd never know what was in the bathroom. She is not my maid, she's not my servant, she's my buddy and my partner. And this is just the way I live. When I go to the bathroom, I don't stand up at that toilet bowl because most men are halfway done before they ever hit the bowl. I sit down. Now, I know you're going to say, oh, well, sit down. Yes, I do. And you see, the fact she don't have to clean up for me, we have a whole lot more time every day to be on the golf course doing what we really enjoy. Okay? She doesn't have to do nothing behind me. And so I think these are the changes I've made and the way I've learned to live so that I can be a benefit to the person I live with and the people about me. And we don't see this, you see, because in most cases, we see the movie, we read the book, we hear the talk. And we just didn't get the message. The drunk don't hear. He don't hear. He hears only what he wants to hear. But the message didn't come through. It's like the drunk that he made this kite. And he never put that tail, that stringer on it. And he's trying to fly this damn thing. And he throws it up in the air and he runs like hell and goes about 30 feet and piles right into the ground. He'd done this about 3 times. And his wife, I don't know if she was an Al-Anon or not, but she looked out the door and said, you bloody dummy, you need more tail. He said, make up your mind. Last night you told me to go fly a kite. So, I mean, these are the things that happen. You know, in 1985, I got a phone call from this fellow, and he said, Lou Finnemore? And I said, yeah. He said, we'd like to know if you'd be our speaker for our national convention. And I said, where is it? He said, it's in the Republic of South Africa. And I thought, my God. Here's this little boy that never had nothing in his life and never been anywhere. And so I said yes. And I got on a plane and flew to London and from there down in through Egypt and into Jan Smuts Airport in Johannesburg. And I had a business at that time, one of the businesses where I could take all the time I wanted. So I took 3 months and they flew me to 28 different places throughout South Africa. But I had some great experiences. Like people that tell me that AA is the same all over the world, those are people who haven't traveled. I can tell you that. I lived in Soweto for just about 4 days with Rufus and his family, and I was the only white person and 7.5 million black people. And they held a civic ceremony and presented me with something that they only present to dignitaries, heads of states. And here was a tramp from Vancouver. They treated me like a king. I went to Durban. They took me from there into Zululand. And Buthelezi, who's head of the Zulu tribe, would not allow anyone in at that time. And here's a tramp from Vancouver get in there because his wife had 18 months of sobriety at that time. This is a ticket to anything you want to do, any place you want to go. Stand up and be counted. Represent this program well. You have no idea of the benefits that comes from just being yourself. If I got $100 in my pocket, I'm as humble as anybody you've ever seen. If I got 1,000, you'd think Errol Flynn just strolled into the room. Today, my life is an open book. Who I've lived with, what I've done for a living, how I live my life today, who my wife is today. My life is a totally open book, and you have no idea. The greatest bed partner you ever get is a clear conscience. And I know sometimes that's a case of a short memory, but it really does work out. So, you know, there's nothing so bad that it cannot be worse. There's nothing that time cannot mend. And troubles, no matter how many you have, must surely come to an end. You have stumbled, well, so have I in my time. Don't think of the past and regret. So you're sorry, God knows, so leave it at that. Let the past be the past and forget. Don't despair, don't give up, but just be yourself, the self that is highest and best. And forgive all my faults, and I'll forgive yours, and we leave up to God all the rest. And in 1992, I want to add this, we got a phone call from that mom of mine, to Linda and I, and she said, Daddy had died years before, and I'm the only child. She said, would you come back home and get me to come out and spend my final years with you? She had never been on a train or a bus or anything in her life, 23 miles the further she'd ever been from home. So we flew back 4,600 miles and picked her up, took her out. 4 years after she was there one night when we were leaving her place, she took my face in her hands and looked at me and said, Louis, I love you. And that was the same face that I hit. And 2 years ago in March when she died, and I look back on this, and the night before we left to go home, and the nurse told us, they said, your mom won't be here in the morning, Lou. So about 3 o'clock the phone rang, and I picked it up. The nurse said, she's still here. So we couldn't sleep, and we get up, and Linda made breakfast, and about 6 o'clock we phoned, and the nurse said, no, your mom is still alive. So we went in and gave her a kiss and bent over her, and I knelt down and took her hand, and Linda said, it's okay to go, Mom. And she said, okay. And that was it. She was gone. But what really gets you when you think you're pretty cool and awesome and far out and totally radical, and this woman that's got grade 5 education, that was the wife of a laborer, her will was opened up, and of all the people that she made the executor of her will was Louis Ralph Finnemore. And she said, I leave my entire estate, 50% to my son, Louis Ralph Finnemore, and 50% to my daughter-in-law, Linda Daunton Finnemore, because Linda was everything to her. And we opened up, and here's just under $200,000 that this grade 5 woman saved out of a laborer's wages to give to this idiot that ran around the country pretending he was something. I'm so grateful that you people were patient with me when I come in. I don't have to rub elbows with all the wheels today, I've done that. When I sit in my den and look around, I've had dinner with the Prime Minister of Canada. I've had some great experiences. Last weekend, I was speaking with Smitty, and another lady was there, and she said, I didn't know you and Linda liked to play golf so much. She said, would you love to go to the Masters? I said, we'd love it. She said, we got tickets for you and Linda next April, so we'll be down here next April for the Masters. Whatever you want in life, if you merit it, you'll get it. If you go after it ahead of time, you can bet your ass on it, you'll lose it. It's happened to me every time in life. God has never let me down. He's given me everything I needed, and He took away everything I didn't need. And that's what this thing is all about. We get this thing one day at a time. We come in here, and we stay sober one day at a time. We give service one day at a time. Today is only the tomorrow that we worried about yesterday. And so I'm so grateful for all the things that's come my way. I'm so grateful to be down here. Today I'm retired. I'm on pension. And I just love every minute of it. I run 4 hours short every day. I don't know how the hell I ever worked. And I don't check into it. You know, I don't allow 1 second of yesterday or 1 second of tomorrow in my head today. Today is spoken for. I allow none of the other ones into my mind. And I think these are the things that is just so precious. But whatever you do, I read 8 pages of this every day. I read Freedom from Bondage every Friday. And I think it's important that I do that, because I see people going by me every day on the freeway and giving you the finger and shaking their fists and pulling in front of you, and it says, easy does it, live and let live. Put them on your dash, will you please? Because we really don't follow instructions too well. It's like the old guy that went to the doctor, and he said, you know, the wife and I have been married 45 years, and our sex life has had us. She could care less. He said, I'm going to give you this prescription. When you go home tonight, he said, just before you go to bed, he said, drop a couple of these in her tea. So they were sitting there in the kitchen. He said, sweetheart, look at that gorgeous moon. She looked out the window, and he dropped 2 in hers and thought, to hell, I'll put 2 in mine, too. So he did. And they both went to bed and fell sound asleep. About 3 o'clock in the morning, she woke up and sat up and threw her hands up and said, I need a man. 2 seconds later, he woke up and sat up and threw his arms up and said, me too. So, so if you've had this spiritual awakening, which it says in the dictionary is a complete transformation of thought as a result of these steps, then we have a message to carry and practice these principles in all our affairs. It takes a long time to get there. Don't be in a rush. Don't be in a rush. Slow down. Live. Smell the flowers. Enjoy the people. Enjoy the hugs, the kisses, the well-wishers, all those things. But just above all, don't take yourself so serious. It's like the minister, I'll close with this, it's meant a lot to me. Was sitting in church on Sunday morning up behind the pulpit in this little cowboy town. And he looked down, there was one cowboy there. And he came down to him and he said, there's only 2 of us here. Do you think we should hold a service? Well, Reverend, he said, I don't know a great deal about cattle or about preaching, but I know quite a bit about cattle. And if I pulled up to a corral with a load of hay and there was a cow there, I'd feed it. So he got the message. And he went up and gave him everything he had in scripture, verse, and song. And when he got done, he came down and he said, what'd you think? And he said, well, Reverend, I don't know a lot about preaching. But I know quite a bit about cattle, and if I pulled up to a corral with a load of hay and there was a cow there, I wouldn't give it the whole load. So I only pray that I can be the type of friend you've been to me. Good night, and God bless you.